This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Cast your memory back to high school English class. Do you remember what was on your required reading list? Maybe The Lord of the Flies, maybe Beowulf. How about anything by Ernest Hemingway? Chances are you were forced to read something that you hated, and you likely cursed your teacher for assigning it. But does that mean we should banish the novel from high school curricula altogether? Our next guests are on opposite corners of the debate, one on the side of abolishing fiction from required reading lists in favor of nonfiction, the other championing the fiction genre, citing its many virtues. Natasha Vargas Cooper is a journalist. She writes for The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times, and The All, among other places. Her essay called Why We Should Stop Teaching Novels to High School Students was in book form earlier this year. Natasha, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks.
And Nick Rapatrazone, staff writer for The Millions, is the author of several books. He's also a public school English teacher in New Jersey. And he wrote an essay in response to Natasha's, calling it The Fictional Lives of High School Teachers. Nick, welcome to the program.
Hi, Virginia.
Hello there. Well, Natasha, I'm going to start with you because you laid down the original argument. Why should we stop teaching novels to high school students?
I based this off of my own experience and my peers. And I say this as somebody who loves novels and has become a huge Ernest Hemingway fan. But I went to a mega public high school with over 4,000 students. We had 38 students to a classroom. I was a pretty socially active and easily distracted young lady. And what I found was when we were reading Fitzgerald, when we were reading Hemingway, that I could not quite grasp what was going on. There was a lot of metaphor. It was very difficult to connect with the malaise and melancholy of a post-World War I emotional atmosphere. And this done in a 54-minute class, only now, at the age of 30, am I understanding the melancholy and the metaphors of Fitzgerald and Hemingway. But one of the other things I've come to recognize is how much I, when I was about 19 or 20, started to read creative nonfiction like Joan Didion, Norman Mailer, Hunter S. Thompson, John Krakauer, and how exciting and direct those works were. Mm-hmm. What if someone were to hand this to me when I was 17 and they were to say, this is a story about a group of people trying to climb Mount Everest, and they can and some can't. And that is, and it's well written, and it's a true story, and it shows you how to compose sentences, and it is engaging, and the stakes are high, and it's immediately understandable. And I wonder, well, would that have been more beneficial to me as opposed to trying to understand Gatsby?
Let's get Nick's response to that. Nick, the title of your response, The Fictional Lives of High School Teachers, was it Natasha suggesting that not all teachers are up to snuff on this, or is it the novel itself that you reacted to?
Well, I think she was speaking, as she says, from a personal direct experience that she had as a high school student. I think when Natasha talks about the need for increase in teaching nonfiction, I agree with her, but I would also counter that many teachers from freshmen on up already do this. They are teaching some of the people in her book list. I had mentioned that I teach Shipping Out by David Foster Wallace. For me, it's not so much having to choose between fiction or nonfiction. It's more to say that we shouldn't stop teaching fiction simply because it is sometimes difficult to connect or interest students in that material.
Natasha, is it the problem of novels as a genre, or is it the traditional Western canon that is assigned in so many English classes, still with the Hemingway, still with the F. Scott Fitzgerald on it, as you experienced it? Does that rely too heavily on these classics?
I think it's both. I think the genre is really challenging in terms of how public schools are structured. And like I said, you have these 50-minute intervals. I think we spent 2 months on Wuthering Heights. Like I said, I'm 30, and now I love Hemingway and Fitzgerald, but that's because I have somewhat of a frame of reference, and why I'm all for kids trying to broaden their horizons and teachers to introduce them to that. I wonder if there's a more valuable genre, format, and title selection that could instantly grab the kids.
What do you think of that, Nick? You mentioned a couple of nonfiction books and essays that appear on your syllabus. Do students respond more favorably to those assignments as opposed to the novels you've assigned?
Well, we just finished As I Lay Dying by William Faulkner, which is, of course, a novel, and it's a very difficult novel. It's told in many different perspectives, and it's about a culture in the world that is far different from suburban New Jersey. When I give my students that book, there's always the initial hesitation, some skepticism about whether they'd be interested in this or not. What I try to do is I try to show them that it's not so much we are looking at individual lives, but we're looking at shared emotions. We're looking at tensions and struggles. And Faulkner writes about the breakdown of a family dynamic. And even with a student who has, from a suburban school like I teach at, where we have 3,000 students, they're going to understand family struggles. They're going to understand when siblings don't get along, when a parent might be overbearing. So I would say that for me, I even have students who I may have to do more work to get them to understand or maybe appreciate David Foster Wallace, even though he's writing nonfiction. A lot of times in a fictive world, because we see full scenes and we see dramatization of interaction and conversation and emotion, it's easier for us to settle into that if they're willing to go that route.
Natasha, I'm guessing that doesn't sound like the experience that you had in high school was similar to the experience that Nick is describing with his students. But a couple of questions here. Do you think you would have come to love the novel if you did not have the framework of learning about them when you were younger? You know, is there a danger in lowering the bar, assuming that kids don't get Hemingway or Dickens or Fitzgerald? You know, let's be honest, A Tale of Two Cities is not Ulysses, right?
Right. Well, you know, I don't see it as lowering the bar, because I think that the works of Joan Didion and of Truman Capote and of Norman Mailer are right up there. To me, it's a sidestep rather than a step back. I have to say that actually what got me really into reading novels was reading longer, in-depth magazine pieces and reading some shorter fiction in The New Yorker. And then eventually it was like, and reading people like Susan Sontag or Christopher Hitchens or Martin Amis's essays in my early 20s, and them talking about how these authors influenced them so much. So I said, okay, like let's see what this is all about. So that is actually what got me into novels. And maybe, and you know, I know other girls my age who loved Jane Eyre and who were totally involved, and it was great. And so, great, keep some novels there, but I think that it would be great to also usher in this other work because it's so exciting, and I really don't think that we get exposed to it. I mean, we didn't in 15 years ago when I was a high school student. We didn't at all.
We're having a discussion about whether classic American novels that tend to make their way onto high school reading lists are really appropriate material for high schoolers. Maybe not appropriate, but if the kids get them. Natasha Vargas-Cooper says no. She went to a big public high school, didn't get a lot of individual teaching attention, and says that when they read novels that she didn't care about, she just checked out. Nick Rapatra-Zone is a public school English teacher in New Jersey. He says that the novels should stay on there. Sure, they're complicated, but that's what part of engaging as an adult is, and that's what we're trying to teach anyway. Nick, I'm wondering if there's a classic novel that you loathe teaching and would be happy to eliminate from the curriculum.
Well, a book that I've moved away from is Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man by James Joyce. Mm-hmm. I think it's an important book. I think it's a complex book. Is definitely, for scholars of literature, that's something you want to look at to help understand Joyce's development before he wrote later novels. It's not a book that students love. They don't love it because it's really, really idiosyncratic and difficult, but also because it sort of has an absence of plot. It's a development of a young man's life, but it's not something that really grabs at you. So what I noticed with that book was, as opposed to focusing on the novel, I started moving towards his collection of short stories, Dubliners. And I noticed that when students had a shorter text to unpack and they could focus on a smaller amount of characters, they started to appreciate it more. So I think part of the problem might be when you ask someone to write or to read a novel, you're asking them to devote a large amount of their life to that book. And reading takes time. And very close reading takes an incredible amount of time.
Sounds like you and Natasha have a little bit of common ground there, that you both think that shorter pieces, you're the short story and she's talking about shorter magazine pieces,
sure,
might work for students.
I wish we read Dubliners. I read Araby my first day in community college, and I was like, oh, this is the most amazing thing I've ever read. Yeah, I mean, I agree, which is that I remember when we were doing Bless Me Ultima or we were doing Wuthering Heights, that was a 3-month process. So if you weren't spot in, that's too bad. I want kids to be excited about reading, and I want kids to read novels, and I want them to learn how to write through reading, not through didactic lecturing. I just think that there might be a different approach, and I think what Nick says is correct, which is that when novels kind of demand a very deep read and a very concentrated read for a long period of time, and, you know, if we had 6 students to a classroom and teachers were paid what they should be and were given the respect that they should and the resources that they should, then I think, yeah, why not? Have them read Ulysses. But unfortunately, that's not how public school is arranged and done.
Nick, any thoughts on that? And also, is there a novel that you absolutely love to teach, but no matter how you present it, just seems to be lost on your students?
Well, the first half of the question, as to is this the right environment for it, I definitely learned, because I've been teaching now for high school for 10 years, I learned to teach fewer novels in a year. I used to teach upwards of 15 or more, which was too much. And now I'm settling in on about 10 or 5. But we're spreading them out a little bit more, and we're doing different things with them. So I definitely think it's a good point to consider the logistics of high school and certainly the support that we're given. As to the novels or the works that I love, it's not quite a hard sell, but it's maybe the harder of the bunch or the more difficult of the bunch, which is The Crying of Lot 49, mm-hmm, by Thomas Pynchon.
Pynchon, yeah.
It was interesting. Last year when we were reading it, really the whole NSA stuff was coming out, and they're starting to see, well, what if, you know, a paranoid character in literature is right, Oedipa Maas? What if the weird way that she sees the world is actually accurate and there is something going on more, you know, complex than she thought? So that's the book that I kind of have to maybe do more work, because Pynchon is difficult for everyone. He's difficult for college students, graduate students, and so on. But I'm willing to do that work because I think it's important to me that students not only love to read things that are real, but they love to read about emotions that are real, even if they're occurring in the lives of imagined characters.
How many students do you have in a typical class, Nick?
For my senior AP literature, I have about 26.
Okay, so can we leave this discussion with a balance of novels and a little bit of nonfiction? Can we go there with that together?
Sure.
Can I propose that we have 60-40 nonfiction? Because what I would love is to progress to the novel, is to, after there has been some reading of creative nonfiction, of reporting, and then of short stories, that the novel is the reward at the end, and it can be Thomas Pynchon. just that they have, like, it's a progression to that point.
Way to frame it, Natasha. What do you say to that, Nick?
I would mess with the percentage a little bit, but I would say that I like the idea that we can put genres and forms of literature in conversation and try to ask a student why a writer would choose a certain form over another. And I think it's healthy for students to see writers doing different things in different ways. It'll take a lot for me to give up End Zone by Donna Lillo or Beloved by Toni Morrison. so I'm going to cling to those pretty tightly.
All right. Nick Rapatrazone, staff writer at The Millions. He's also author of several books and a public school English teacher in New Jersey. Nick, thank you.
Thank you.
And Natasha Vargas Cooper, thanks for helping us get to sort of yes. We appreciate that.
This is my mission.
Natasha is a freelance journalist. She writes for The Atlantic Monthly, Book Forum, and The All, among other places. And you'll find a link to read both articles written by our guests at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd also love to know what you think. Were novels kryptonite for you in high school? Do you wish you'd had more exposure to nonfiction? You can share your favorite and most reviled novels from high school. That's at our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. We just heard two perspectives on what should be on high school reading lists. Well, no matter what kids are reading, high school is a time for establishing identities that can follow people for a lifetime. We're going to roam the hallways and dark corners of adolescence a bit more with this story from Sean Hurley.
I can't quite believe we called the smoker kids, the ne'er-do-wells in high school, rats. But we did. He's a rat, I suppose we'd sometimes say, hanging a curtain over a doomed soul. Not a Jimmy Cagney dirty rat. We had our own feeling for the word. A rat was a kid in a too big leather jacket who scuffed the hall floors with the rubber tire soles of his monster boots. They were like odd pirate ships, and they moved among us with a vague sense of pillaging. Who sometimes dumped the books from your nervous clutch, as though to create a little movie of who you were. They'd make a key, dramatic scene in your otherwise silent, actionless film. And everything would be revealed. In the crease of your good behavior, you were nothing but a rabbit. On your knees, flushed and ruined, scooping papers together as the world laughed and judged and knew your very core, a bureaucrat in the making, a folded-up answer no one would ever want to read. The rats, who smoked outside the backfire door, who smelled like vodka in class, who lurked in the dark hall, who were always late, who never had passes, who sometimes just left, and who never quite arrived anywhere. Who got called down to the office day after day, who had knit brows, and who could sometimes laugh harder with more freedom than any of us, and yet with the ring of forgery, as though this was the first time they'd ever laughed. We fell for their toneless, make-believe, expletive-rich, old man voices. They were the best actors in school, by far. That they were battling against cruel fathers or disparaging mothers or brothers that beat them, we didn't know, but we saw they wore the outfit of soldiers, a uniform that spoke to a truth we couldn't suspect about a war we never saw. They never had pencils, they never had notebooks. School was important only as a reprieve, for a game of dice, for candy, cigarettes. We were seeing them in the downtime, in the truce that was made by their distance from the front line. But a few times over your 4 years at high school, you would, for a short time, get to know a rat. A fringe rat, you'd think, an eccentric specimen. One who happened to be gifted at trigonometry or who liked a particular book. You would warm together over some shared object. They'd get you to come their way a bit, and you'd get them to come yours. You'd smoke a cigarette, skip a class or a whole day with them, and experience the thrill of lawlessness. And in return, they would get to see what it was like to be so innocent, to be so hopeful, to think so highly of the future without regard to any proof, and to be so nervous about such small things as homework and tests as never before had bothered them. And for that moment, the dumb dream of picket fences and happy families and combed hair and clean clothes would rise up before them to witness. They would fall hard for it. And then, because they had to, they would burn it to the ground.
NHPR's Sean Hurley. You can read his story, Rats, or pass it on to a friend by going to wordofmouthradio.org. Now stay with us for a writer who, like the rats in Sean's story, runs the high wire between humor and angst. A conversation with best-selling author Sam Lipsight when Word of Mouth continues after the news from NHPR.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. A 36-year-old single pre-K teacher and would-be poet fantasizes about having a rich man's baby. A heroin addict schemes to write a children's book on boxer Marvelous Marvin Hagler, thinking the word count for kids' books is small and he'd get paid more quickly. The daughter of a Holocaust survivor struggles with an addiction to crack and takes in a recovering neo-Nazi. A memoirist realizes the public no longer wants to hear about his misery. These are just a few of the hapless, feckless, and ultimately hysterical inhabitants of The Fun Parts, a collection of stories by Sam Lipsight. His best-selling book, The Ask, helped firmly establish Sam Lipsight as one of our premier contemporary satirists. And we're so glad to have him with us. Sam Lipsight, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks, Virginia.
Now, you had the enormous success with your novel, The Ask, and then came this collection of short stories, now out in paperback. I wonder if it was kind of a breather to write short stories after a novel.
Well, I wouldn't say it was a breather, because those stories took as much out of me as the novel.
No walk in the park?
No, it's never a walk in the park. More like a crawl through the ditch. It was nice to change up, and I started with short stories, and I was happy to get the chance to try them again.
And they're sort of linked together. At least some of the characters do reappear. I'm thinking of Tova.
Yes.
She's a poet-turned-school teacher. We meet her in the first story, The Climbing Room. She turns maybe into a girlfriend of an old lecherous guy, at least in her fantasy. I wonder if maybe there were makings of the novels for some of these stories.
Well, I was excited about getting to revisit Tova in another story. And, I like when my stories and even my novels overlap with characters or towns or a few situations. And it kind of keeps things alive for me in a way.
The Climber Room is set in the present, as far as I can tell, whereas the other story that she is in the past, and it's really not her story.
Right.
Clinton has just been re-elected, we learned, so it's somewhere in the middle of the 90s.
There's a little time stamp in the story when I say that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And she's a very different person, a much more pretentious person, because she's had a chapbook out of poetry. There is this sense of the kind of pretension of the artist, and I wonder if that is something you get to confront a fair bit living there in Manhattan.
Well, perhaps there's a greater share of that here than in some other places, but I think it's not something I condemn in young people. I think it's a part of youth and part of wanting to be an artist and part of that desire. I just was interested in watching Tova move from that, and it's kind of sad because she may be pretentious, but she's also confident and she's writing poetry.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, those things kind of go together.
You know, a lot of people in this book are troubled. We're all a little bit broken. I mean, are we, Sam Lipsight? Is that the way you see us?
Well, yes, but it's not a doomsday scenario. I think it helps when we acknowledge our flaws and our mistakes and our sorrows, and then we try to endure.
But you do seem to have a kind of affection or tenderness for the
broken. Absolutely. I think a writer I always liked named Harry Cruse said, you know, all fiction should be about the crushing of the human heart. And because that's what we all go through at different times in our life. And I don't think it's negative or dark to say so. It's just an acknowledgement, and then we go on and see what we can salvage.
No, we don't just have the broken and deluded, but there are also the climbers. There are so many details I loved about these climbers. You know, children named Desdemona or Prague.
Right.
A home described as inspiring aspirational sconce porn.
Yeah.
So there's an equal measure of looking, I guess, through the sides of your eyes at those on the top rung of the social ladder as the bottom.
Yes, and also the way we look at that top rung.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a lot of what I'm interested in getting to is that gap between what we want and what we get, what we think we're going to get, all of that. It's in that area is where I think all the desire and fear is, and all the heartbreak and the attempts to put it back together.
Mm-hmm. We also meet people who get ridiculed. There are two stories that I'm thinking of here about lonesome boys. The Dungeon Master is about a group of kids who play Dungeons and Dragons together because they're rejected even from the school's Dungeons and Dragon Club.
Yeah, that's a major indignity. they're not good enough for the school's Dungeons and Dragons Club.
There's also an ode to Old Corn. This is the fattest kid in the school. He wants to remake himself as a shot putter. Both of them made me feel very sad and lonely and made me wonder about you growing up. I mean, is that just normal, lonesome adolescent stuff, or did you have an especially lonesome childhood?
I think that when you're a kid, you can't imagine anyone feeling more lonesome than you do.
Hmm.
But I don't think it was. I think it was pretty garden variety adolescence. We're so sensitive at that time, and the world is full of pain and wonder at that time. We feel things so intensely. And I'm a teacher and I teach creative writing, and sometimes students hand in a story that's about a breakup, and they're 19 or 20. And it's filled with all of this incredible emotion. And on the one hand, I think, well, they don't get that this is just a college romance and it'll pass and time will heal. But then I also think, you know, this is when people feel the most in some ways.
Mm.
And I have to respect that, too.
We're talking with Sam Lipsight. His very funny collection of short stories called The Fun Parts is now out in paperback. Sam, there are also plenty of people who are grown up and I guess should know better, but of course we don't. The lies that we tell ourselves, I think, is another theme that runs through here. I'm thinking of Mandy. She's the daughter of a Holocaust survivor who hooks up with a neo-Nazi who's trying to change his ways. She does get together with him and thinks, when he's a little more stable, I'll break up with him. This illusion, this illusion of control. And she's in recovery. And you do a pretty close observation of Manhattan recovery group weirdness, you call it. I wonder how you got the insight on this, what is considered a sort of secret society.
Well, it's not so secret anymore. I think it's represented quite a bit on television and in novels and the nonfiction, but I've written about it in the past. When I was younger, I had my problems and observed lots of environments, including jail cells and so forth. So I think we all kind of relate to some sort of obsessional or compulsive behavior, some addictive traits, some ways in which we feel almost possessed. I think. I don't think that's just about a drug or just about a drink. I think that's about a lot of things and a lot of dynamics and a lot of relationships between people.
Yeah, I guess so. We can all be relief-seeking missiles.
Yeah, I like that.
In our own way. Well, I wonder for you, Sam, you know, you've written so many funny, bitingly funny books, great satire and novels and short stories. Do you ever think about, I'm going to write something and it's just not going to be funny at all? I mean, I'm going to leave all humor out of it. Is that something you're even capable of?
Well, I think I've had moments where I thought, well, if I just kept it really flat and there wasn't any play in the language and it wasn't, the scenes weren't comic, you know, I'd probably sell more books on the international market or something. But I've come to realize that I'm a certain kind of writer. I don't really get middling reviews. I get Savage Attacks or really big raves, and I just hear from a lot of people who care about what I'm doing, and that inspires me. And at a certain point, you realize who you are and what you're doing. I was, the writer Thomas McGuane,
mm-hmm.
And I was recently on a panel with him, and he's a hero of mine, and it was a thrill just to be there with him. But he was talking a bit about you write comic novels, don't win prizes, but in a way, they end up being incredibly important to people. So you just got to be happy with that.
I wonder why that is. That sort of, there's nothing, lukewarm about what you do. You either incite the passionate love or attacks.
I mean, I assume that's a good thing. I mean, sometimes, I really don't mind those attacks, because at least I feel like I riled somebody up.
Hmm.
At least somebody felt something.
Do your kids think you're funny?
No, not at all. And my son thinks he's, God's gift to comedy, and thinks I'm Drek. So,
well, I guess there are some critics you just cannot win over.
Right.
Well, Sam Lipsight, I really want to thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
Sam Lipsight's very funny collection of short stories is The Fun Parts, and it's now out in paperback. You'll find more on the book and his other work, including the best-selling novel The Ask and others, at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, a blogger who reports from his parents' home in Philly, who's become a Vatican insider. We'll talk with him about Francis's shake-em-up papacy and how he became the go-to guy for insider stories. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last week, Silvio Berlusconi's publishing company, Mondadori, released the first issue of Il Mio Papa. It's a weekly magazine that, at first glance, looks like your typical gossip rag. Upon closer inspection, however, the bold headlines and glossy photos are not revealing the latest celebrity diet, but Pope Francis's latest homily. Yes, Il Mio Papa is all about the pontiff. Although a gossip magazine dedicated to the Pope may come as a surprise, the Catholic Church is no stranger to gossip, as evidenced by Whispers in the Loggia, a wildly popular blog that has been dishing the Catholic scoop for nearly a decade. Last week, the site had over 5 million visitors, and Rocco Palmo joins me to discuss papal mania and how he became the go-to guy for insider stories. Rocco, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Anytime, Virginia. Thank you.
For those who do not know the Catholic cosmology, what does Whispers in the Loggia mean?
Okay, well, the Vatican, the Apostolic Palace, the building next to St. Peter's itself, date from the 15th, 16th century. These were the times when the church was the great patron of the arts. Of course, Michelangelo did the Sistine Chapel. You have, Raphael, Donatello, frescoes all over the place. And so they eventually, the popes ran out of rooms. So they eventually just sent the artists out and commissioned to paint the hallways. And those hallways are called the loggias. It's in English, it would be something like an arcade or a colonnade. In the loggia corridor of our seminary, it was there that I was told who would succeed my mentor and be the next Archbishop of Philadelphia 2 months before it was announced. And in the church, those things are held so tightly that if anyone who is officially informed of an appointment leaks it in advance, they're excommunicated. But that story of hearing the name here, when I was in college 12 years ago, just made me realize, well, this is how news happens. We don't find out news on the cover in the newspaper. You find out in phone calls and, walking along with folks at school or at the office.
Well, since you're keeping an ear to the shakeups going on in the Vatican, we'd love to know, what is the most recent scoop to come out of Rome?
Well, it's a very interesting time because, obviously the Pope has absolute power in the life of the church. And so we've had several, these shakeups, but it used to be that you, because Pope Benedict had worked in the Vatican for 23 years and had a very well-established team around him and worked within the existing Vatican structure, so you would get leaks all the time. With Francis, they were almost non-existent anymore because the Pope has his own parallel staff he's put into place. And the Vatican officials who used to decide things for Benedict or would help Benedict prepare documents and everything only know what happens now when they get the completed document from the Pope and are told to translate it hours before its release.
Well, he also said he wants to create a more transparent church. So is that what he's doing? He's letting people know before they have a chance to leak?
The transparency is going to be in terms of a new office, major office for the economy, which was founded last week, which is going to basically be an umbrella office for everything fiscal in the Vatican. And they're talking about even one unified financial statement for what until now has been 15 different financial entities. But he also wants a much more collaborative spirit of governance in the church, and not just among cardinals and bishops, but even including lay people. And only now has top officials begun to speak about openly, but for months it's been my understanding that his reform of the Vatican offices, before it's complete within the next probably 2 years, I wouldn't be surprised if the ultimate glass ceiling were shattered in that a laywoman became head of a Vatican office, a position that until now has only been held by cardinals.
Wowie. Can we quote you on that one?
Yeah, well, I've been saying it for months, so it's and even now the Pope himself is talking about it in the papers. So I think you can quote me on it now.
Well, Rocco, you were just talking about, you know, how he wants to be a consensus builder, but you also said reform. You know, those things don't often go well together. You reported on a couple of swipes that he took at cardinals on Ash Wednesday. Not the way to build consensus.
Well, again, his consensus is coming from a different crowd in terms of reform of governance, in terms of having a greater lay presence in the life of the church. You know, these calls for reform are very prevalent, but in that caste system, if you will, that's existed in Rome for the last 30, 40 years, mostly dominated by Italians who have brought their own financial interests and financial mismanagement, to be honest, to the table in the Vatican. Basically, he's trying to nudge them over to the side. And the swipe on Ash Wednesday was extraordinary. It was unscripted in his homily, the text of which was already prepared and had been translated. But he started talking in this little world of ours, he said, I see these daily power struggles for positions. And the cardinals were all sitting around him as he was saying this. And, you know, the cameras are there and all. And he said, and I keep thinking to myself that these people, meaning these cardinals, these aides, are trying to play God. And he said, and they still don't realize that they aren't God. And he used that in the context of Lent for all of us, is remembering that God is God and we are just his creatures.
Well, we're talking to a Vatican insider, somebody you might imagine as an old shadowy figure in a cloak, but instead we're talking to a young American guy, 31-year-old Rocco Palmo. He's author of a blog called Whispers in the Loggia. But your site reveals to us that Vatican insiders like to gossip with the best of us.
They do, but, you know, at the same time, this isn't the Kardashians, you know. Well, if anything, the clothing can even be a lot better than the Kardashians. But you know, I mean, you have to distinguish, you know, that sense of these whispers in the loggia. This is how news begins. You know, it's very tightly held. But this is policy stuff. You know, I mean, Francis, if anything, has been an enemy of gossip in terms of that kind of trying to discredit people. That's how in the church we define gossip. Gossip is sinful. It's not something I do. But, you know, I mean, there's a reason why things like the Thornbirds, the Borgias, even the Da Vinci Code have become such huge, you know, the world has been fascinated by the Catholic Church, and it should be. It's a fascinating beat. It's the oldest institution in the world.
But the Catholic Church is an infamously impenetrable organization, and I was reading up on you in the Washington Post and other newspapers that talked about what incredible sources you had. How did you manage to gain access to the inside?
It's a bunch of things, you know. Coming from a place like Philadelphia, like Boston, especially in these northeastern environments, had such a deep Catholic ethos. A Catholic culture. So, but especially in a place like Philly, there had been long ties to Rome. There's a history of cardinals here in this city. And growing up, I got to know the cardinal here in Philadelphia, a guy named Anthony Bevilacqua. I was fascinated with the church, and he just answered all my dumb questions and showed me the ropes, expecting that I would become a priest. Well, I let him down on that, but something else sat. And I thought to myself, okay, so I'm not going to be a priest. What am I going to do with all this trivia I know and all these contacts? But I found my love was in journalism, was in the press. My father worked for the newspapers here for 30 years. And so I just, from those years with the Cardinal and from studying the Holy See in college, geopolitically, I just had a lot of friends in a lot of different places, priests, bishops, whatever. And so it's just kind of snowballed since. And there are new sources, new friends, new places to look into and brush up on.
You mentioned a man that you write about in your blog and acknowledge as a mentor, Anthony Bevilacqua, the Cardinal of Philadelphia, who died before the trial began investigating child sex abuse complaints lodged against dozens of priests in his own archdiocese. So that, of course, we can't talk about the Catholic Church without talking about the sex abuse scandal that has plagued it for the past 10 or 15 years. I'm wondering if you've been ever asked not to print or to retract a story or been dissuaded from printing a story that deals with the sex abuse scandal and other problems within the church.
I've never been pressured on a story that had to do with sex abuse. You know, if anything, especially the current generation of leadership knows the failures of the past, knows that in some dioceses, failures continue even now. And that the church has to be completely honest about its failures and has to be, you know, transparent about it, but also has to be not just committed, but bullish, driven to make sure it doesn't happen again. If the church doesn't have its house in order on abuse, then you can forget about people listening on anything else or any moral credibility on anything else. Now, I have to say, too, when it comes to Bevilacqua, he was very good to me, taught me so much, and I owe so much to him, but, you know, I can't overlook his failure. I can't whitewash that. You know, he made some abhorrent decisions that have caused suffering, that continue causing suffering in the lives of victims, their parents, their families, this whole diocese. And it's tough when you're in that, you know, in the position of having to write about, but saying this is someone who was so good to me and who made decisions that were just so horrible for other people. And if anything, it really hit home in 2011 when the second grand jury on the diocese, on this archdiocese, was released, which charged one of Bevilacqua's aides with a cover-up. And especially coming from the history I come from, you know, I just feel an ever greater obligation to, you know, hold the church's feet to the fire on this and help them be accountable. But the thing is, you know, in terms of my funding structure, I live by reader donations. I don't have advertising. I'm not, you know, a propagandist. I'm not funded by any official church entity. There are times when I'm asked, you know, to hold a story or to not do a story. But, you know, basically my independence is not having to rely on church organs for funding. If anything, I will not accept donations from the American bishops so that they can't editorially interfere with my coverage.
Rocco Palmo, author of the Whispers in the Loggia blog. Thank you so much for opening the Vatican vault for us.
Anytime, Virginia. Anytime, you know, anytime you want more from the vault, just give me a shout. Call in.
Rocco Palmo is Catholic commentator and founder of Whispers in the Loggia blog. We have a link to read it yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us today. If you do like what you heard, there is much more to listen to at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us and send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. Earlier in the show, we heard a debate over what should be on the required reading list for high school English classes. We'd love to hear what you think. Do the classics like Beowulf or Ethan Frome or The Scarlet Letter scare kids off from reading? Is there a case to be made to include more contemporary nonfiction books? Should we meet kids where they are and include The Hunger Games? You can join the conversation in progress on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And unlike in high school, you can actually have this debate. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio and online anytime at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.